Waikato Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome back. Today, we are doing a deep dive into a truly groundbreaking book. It's Daniel Kahneman's Thinking, Fast and Slow.
It really is monumental, isn't it? This isn't just, you know, an academic text. It's almost like an owner's manual for your own brain.
Absolutely. And our mission today is to unpack his incredible research. Research that basically dismantled that whole idea of the rational human actor. The econ, as he calls it.
Right, the perfectly logical being. Kahneman showed us that's not really us. We're much more complex. We make predictable mistakes.
And this book gives you the tools to understand why. It tackles that fundamental question, how do we actually think? And why are our decisions often, you know, flawed in these very specific ways?
Exactly. And importantly, these aren't just random slip-ups. Kahneman demonstrated they're systematic. They come from the very way our minds are structured.
So let's talk a bit about the man himself, Daniel Kahneman. He sadly passed away just recently in 2024.
A huge loss. He was genuinely revolutionary. A psychologist who won the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences back in 2002.
Which is pretty unusual, right? A psychologist getting the big economics prize.
It's incredibly rare, and it speaks volumes about his impact. He basically forced economics to confront the reality of human psychology. He integrated cognitive psychology right into economic thinking.
He essentially created the field we now call behavioral economics.
Pretty much, yeah. And a lot of this foundational work, particularly on prospect theory, was done with his longtime collaborator, Amos Tversky.
Another brilliant mind. Their partnership is legendary in psychology.
It is. They designed these really elegant experiments that just consistently revealed these biases in our thinking, how we deviate from pure logic and probability in predictable ways.
So Kahneman's work wasn't just theoretical. It was based on actual experiments showing how we're irrational and, crucially, why. He replaced the theoretical econ with the much more realistic, sometimes messy, human.
Okay, so the central idea, the core thesis of the whole book, what is it?
It boils down to this. Our thinking is governed by two different systems, System 1 and System 2.
Right. System 1 is the fast one. It's automatic, intuitive, effortless. Think recognizing a face or knowing 2 + 2 = 4 or getting a sudden gut feeling.
That's your System 1 working behind the scenes, generating impressions and feelings almost instantly.
Then you've got System 2. That's the slow, deliberate, effortful system. It requires attention, concentration.
Like when you're doing a tough calculation, say 17 times 24, or maybe carefully comparing two different products. That's System 2 engaging. It's the conscious you, the one that reasons things out.
But here's the kicker. System 2. Well, it's kind of lazy. It takes effort to use it. And our mental energy, our attention is limited. Kahneman talks about ego depletion.
Ego depletion, meaning using System 2 actually tires you out.
Exactly. And when System 2 is tired or distracted or just doesn't feel like working hard, it tends to just go along with whatever System 1 suggests. It defaults to endorsing the quick, intuitive answer.
So System 1 is like this eager, fast-acting machine constantly feeding suggestions.
Uh-huh.
And System 2 is supposed to be the quality control, but it often just rubber stamps System 1's output.
That's a great way to put it. And System 1 relies heavily on mental shortcuts, these heuristics. They're usually efficient, but they're also the source of many of our systematic errors, our cognitive biases.
Okay, let's get into that. If System 2 gets depleted, System 1 takes over more. And you mentioned System 1 likes things easy.
Right, it operates on cognitive ease. Things that feel familiar, simple, easy to process. System 1 likes those. And crucially, it equates that ease with truth.
That's the illusion of truth you mentioned. If something is presented clearly, maybe repeated often, we're more likely to believe it just because it feels right, feels easy.
Precisely. System 1 doesn't really stop to check the facts if something feels fluent and coherent. It just accepts it, which can be, well, problematic.
Okay, so how do these heuristics work in practice? You mentioned the representativeness heuristic.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This is where we judge how likely something is based on how much it resembles a stereotype or prototype in our minds, often ignoring actual statistics, the base rates.
Ah, the famous Linda problem fits here, doesn't it?
It does. The classic example. Linda is described as outspoken, concerned with social justice, very liberal profile. Then people are asked, is it more likely she's A, a bank teller, or B, a bank teller who is active in the feminist movement?
And most people intuitively jump to B, right? Because feminist bank teller feels more representative of the description.
Exactly. But logically, it's impossible. The group of feminist bank tellers is a subset of the group of all bank tellers, so A has to be more probable.
But System 1 doesn't do the math. It substitutes the hard probability question with an easier one. How much does Linda resemble my stereotype of a feminist?
Spot on. System 1 gives a quick, coherent, but statistically wrong answer. And lazy System 2 often doesn't bother to correct it.
Okay, what about the availability heuristic?
This one's about judging frequency or probability based on how easily examples come to mind. If you can easily think of instances of something, you assume it's common.
So that's why things like, say, plane crashes or shark attacks seem like bigger risks than they are, because they get tons of media coverage, they're vivid, dramatic.
Exactly. They are highly available in your memory. So System 1 concludes they must be relatively frequent, even if statistically driving your car is far riskier.
It's fascinating how these shortcuts shape our perception of risk.
Definitely. And this reliance on easy answers and coherent stories leads to other major biases, especially in professional settings. Take the planning fallacy.
Oh boy, everyone's experienced this. Why do projects always seem to take longer and cost more than planned?
Because we almost always take the inside view. We focus on the specifics of our project, our skills, our best case scenario. We see our situation as unique.
And we ignore the outside view.
Right. We ignore the statistical track record of countless similar projects that went over budget or past deadline. System 1 prefers the optimistic, flattering story about our own specific case. It doesn't like depressing statistics.
That makes sense. And this ties into hindsight bias too, doesn't it? The I knew it all along effect.
Absolutely. Once an event happens, especially a negative one, our minds automatically construct a narrative that makes it seem like it was predictable, even inevitable.
We rewrite history in our heads to make it make sense.
We do. And the danger there isn't just that we fail to learn accurately from the past. It also makes us judge others' decisions unfairly. We think we wouldn't have made that mistake because the outcome seems so obvious now.
Okay, this shaping of narrative leads us nicely into Kahneman's really big contribution, the one that won the Nobel, prospect theory.
Yes. This was a huge shift from classical economics. Old theories focused on the utility of absolute wealth, like how happy are you with $100,000 versus $110,000.
But prospect theory looks at it differently.
Totally differently. It focuses on the utility of gains and losses relative to a reference point. It's not about how much you have, but how much you gain or lose compared to what you expected or had before.
And the key insight here is loss aversion.
That's the big one. The pain of a loss feels psychologically much stronger than the pleasure of an equivalent gain.
How much stronger? Did they quantify it?
They did. Roughly twice as strong. Losing $100 hurts about twice as much as gaining $100 feels good. That 2.1 ratio is incredibly powerful in explaining behavior.
Wow. So that explains things like the endowment effect, why we overvalue things we own.
Precisely. Selling your old mug or your concert ticket feels like a loss. And because losses loom larger than gains, you demand a higher price to part with it than what a neutral buyer might be willing to pay. Yeah. Giving it up hurts more than the cash feels good.
Okay, pulling back a bit, what are some of the big overarching themes or messages from the book?
Well, one huge one is that our biases are errors in thinking. They're systematic. They aren't random. They come from the way our minds are built.
And knowing they're systematic means they're predictable.
Exactly. And if they're predictable, you can start to anticipate them, maybe even counteract them. Naming the bias, like recognizing you might be prone to anchoring or loss aversion in a situation, gives you some power over it.
Okay, that's empowering. What else?
Another key theme. Overconfidence seems to be our default setting. System 1 is brilliant at creating coherent stories from limited, sometimes shaky, evidence. And that feeling of coherence translates directly into a feeling of confidence.
Kahneman calls that the illusion of validity, right? Confidence doesn't necessarily mean accuracy.
Not at all. It just means the story System 1 cooked up feels neat and tidy. That's why, you know, expert predictions in complex fields like politics or finance are often no better than flipping a coin. The confidence is real, but the accuracy, less so.
That's a sobering thought for experts everywhere. And the third big theme.
This one's maybe the most profound, philosophically. It's the two selves paradox, the idea that we have an experiencing self and a remembering self.
Okay, what's the difference?
The experiencing self lives life moment by moment. It feels the pain, the pleasure, the boredom. But the remembering self is the one that keeps score, tells the story of our life, and makes decisions about the future.
And the remembering self is the one in charge?
Largely, yes.
Yeah.
Kahneman's famous colonoscopy experiment showed this dramatically. People's memory of the painful procedure wasn't based on the total amount of pain or how long it lasted.
What was it based on then?
It was dominated by two things: the moment of peak pain and how the procedure ended. This is the peak end rule. The duration of the pain was almost completely ignored. Duration neglect.
So our memories heavily edit our experiences, and we make future choices based on those edited memories, not the actual lived experience.
That's the paradox. The remembering self calls the shots, often based on a very selective summary of what the experiencing self actually went through.
Kahneman really had a way with words, didn't he? The book is full of these concise, memorable lines that just stick with you.
Oh, absolutely. Like this one, capturing the power of System 1. System 1 is the secret author of many of the choices and judgments you make.
That is unsettling. The idea that your conscious self, your I, is often just signing off on decisions already made automatically.
It really makes you think about free will, doesn't it? And then there's the line that quantifies loss aversion so clearly. The psychological pain that a loss generates is more than twice as intense as the pleasure that a gain of the same size generates.
That 2-to-1 ratio, it's such a core finding. If you take away one number, maybe that's the one.
Agreed. And finally, on the two selves, this quote is just, wow. Odd as it may seem, I am my remembering self, and the experiencing self who does my living is like a stranger to me.
That really drives home the dilemma. Are we living to have good experiences moment to moment, or are we living to build good memories, a good story?
A question with deep implications. And these aren't just abstract ideas. They have very real-world applications, especially in areas like policy and governance.
You mean nudging, using these insights to design choices.
Exactly. Designing choice architecture that gently pushes people towards better decisions, working with our cognitive biases instead of fighting them.
Like making organ donation opt-out instead of opt-in.
That's a classic example. It dramatically increases donation rates simply by leveraging our tendency to stick with the default option system 2's laziness again, or automatic enrollment in retirement savings plans.
Makes sense. What about in business or professional life?
Well, actively fighting the planning fallacy is crucial. Managers need to consciously seek out the outside view. Don't just rely on your team's optimistic projections for a project.
So look at the hard data. How long did similar projects actually take? What were the real costs?
Yes. Use reference class forecasting. Anchor your estimates in reality, not just optimistic hopes. It takes effort engaging System 2, but it prevents costly failures.
And even in personal relationship.
Definitely. Just being aware of hindsight bias can make you a more understanding friend or partner. When things go wrong for someone, resist that urge to say, "I told you so," or think, "I saw that coming."
Because you probably didn't see it as clearly beforehand as your remembering self now claims you did.
Exactly. Recognizing that bias fosters empathy and better communication.
So wrapping up, what's the biggest thing you take away from this book? What really sticks with you?
For me, it's the profound sense of intellectual humility it instills. You realize just how easily your own mind can trick you. The goal isn't to become perfectly rational.
Yeah.
That's impossible.
So what is the goal then?
It's about recognizing the situations where the stakes are high. Big financial decisions, important strategic choices, crucial judgments about people, and in those moments, deliberately slowing down, forcing yourself to engage that effortful analytical system too.
Yeah, that resonates. My takeaway is similar. It's having this richer, more accurate vocabulary to understand why people, including myself, behave the way we do, moving beyond just calling someone irrational.
Right. Moving from seeing people as these idealized icons to understanding them as complex, psychologically real humans.
Now we have concepts like loss aversion, anchoring, availability heuristic, planning fallacy. It gives you a framework to ask better questions, to analyze decisions more effectively.
That framework itself is incredibly powerful. It changes how you see the world, really.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.